Welcome tonight to the April 20th, 4/2020 edition of this American Countdown tonight on Monday, April 20th. And tonight resolved whether or not it's time to indict China for the consequences of this pandemic. Tonight we'll have a further conversation and discussion with Jack Posobiec, who has experience firsthand with China and China's policies and politics, was one of the earliest warners of the risk of this pandemic and its spread and how its policy consequences could be as infectious as the virus itself. In that context, let's talk about how China has endangered not only America's economic security over the past 20 years, but its political security, its information technology, its national security, its health security. The health scare we're currently experiencing is not something that's new in terms of arising or originating from China, both in terms of history and in terms of history over centuries and in terms of recent history. In addition, it's directly correlated to China's deliberate policies and political decision making. This includes not only China's decisions regarding its wet markets, but also China's reactions and actions concerning its use of pandemic policy, its disclosure of information to the world that is transparent and honest, China's continued efforts at developing viruses in its various labs for experimentation purposes without the requisite degrees of safety and security protocols, as was being warned and has now been leaked in State Department cables over just the last several weeks, concerns that this virus may be man-made and may have originated from a lab in China and that China tried to cover it up. But that's just one piece of a larger story. For example, if you simply go to Wikipedia and look up indictments related to Chinese espionage, just in the year 2015, you'll find over 35. That's the kind of risk that we're facing. Chinese hackers, China's role with North Korea. If you do any research with North Korea, you'll discover that their policies are really driven by China, that they are essentially used as a mechanism by which China terrifies the rest of the world into conforming to certain Chinese policy, because maybe the North Koreans will go nuts and nuke everybody. You dig in, North Korea is almost entirely dependent for its survival, its literal physical survival, on its economic, political, and social ties to China. So whether we're talking about North Korea, whether we're talking about pandemics, whether we're talking about manufacturing, talking about how China in 1990 only had less than 4% of global manufacturing. Today, almost a quarter of global manufacturing is controlled by China. How more and more studies show that the loss of jobs in the West, particularly in the United States, high-paying jobs, good-paying jobs that produced economic security, that produced good, thriving communities, were stripped and ripped away by the inclusion of China in the World Trade Organization and the favorable trade terms in 2001. That was a combined compromise of the Clinton and Bush regimes. Is it any coincidence that there are ties between the Clintons and Chinese billionaires and illicit donations that happened in the 1996 campaign and later? Is it any coincidence that there are ties between China and the Biden family? Is it any coincidence that there are ties between China and the Bush family? This long history of effectively our American elite selling out America's future, America's safety, America's security, and America's economy to China has now come home to roost in dead bodies in morgues in America and the rest of the world. China was at particular risk of a pandemic spread. China knew this. And let's go through some of the history. Let's start with the Black Plague. Origins of the Black Death traced back to China. Gene sequencing has revealed in historical studies. This is from Medical News Today. Gene sequencing, from which scientists can gather hereditary data of organisms, revealed that the Black Death, often referred to as the plague, which reduced the world's total population by about 100 million at a time that the world's population was much smaller, originated from China over 2,000 years ago. Now, when this pandemic broke out in China, what did China do? China didn't warn the public of the likely pandemic for at least 6 critical days. Indeed, they told the World Health Organization, and the World Health Organization in turn told the world that this disease could not even be spread human to human. Whereas if you look at the details, China knew about the virus potentially all the way back to November. According to this headline from Politico and other locations and Bloomberg News, China concealed, and by the way, if it comes from Bloomberg, you know it's really, really, really true, because Bloomberg had tight ties to China. Bloomberg News has tight ties to China. Bloomberg himself was unwilling to be critical of China much at all in his political recent history. And yet even they are admitting in this headline, China concealed the extent of the virus outbreak, according to U.S. intelligence reports. Not only that, China hid the work of the woman who identified the genome makeup of this novel coronavirus, the woman sometimes called the Bat Lady because of her investigation of bat-related viruses, withholding that information from the world for weeks and months. This was not something that was new. SARS was a virus outbreak that was tied potentially to bats. Lead infection and virologist doctors across the, and microbacterial doctors across the globe had warned that China was the perfect petri dish for the next pandemic. This is just one of the articles that you can find, and there's over 50 in the medical journal literature, Bat Coronaviruses in China. And this was put out prior to COVID-19 coming out. And it goes and it talks about SARS. It talks about different forms of SARS. It talks about MERS. And it talks about the investigation of bat coronaviruses becomes an urgent issue for the detection of early warning sign, which in turn, it measures the impact of such future outbreaks in China. The geographical distribution of bat coronaviruses in China makes it a particular virus hotspot and cross-species transmission potential. So this has been known in China for centuries, but especially since the SARS outbreak in 2003. Yet China took no action to reduce the amount of people buying bats in its wet markets. China took no meaningful action to increase the safety of its experimentation in its labs on potential viruses, particularly coronaviruses from bats. So, and when they had reason to believe there was a cause for concern back in November, they took retaliatory and suppressive action rather than disclosure action. And for a critical week in mid-January, hid essential and fundamental information to the world, leading the world to believe that in fact there was no risk of exposure, that in fact there was no even human-to-human transmission. And while they were shutting down travel within China from Wuhan, where this virus was taking off, where it was a epidemic epicenter, they were letting people from Wuhan travel all around the world, most critically to Europe, where in fact it would lead to spreading to New York and the United States. This goes back to a history. China has a long, notorious history of being the origin source of pandemics because of various habits within its culture, its culinary habits, and other trading patterns that it continuously engages in and poses a human risk to the rest of the world. China is simply not safe for the rest of the world in the way they conduct their policy. Another article, this one from National Geographic and from Seeker, bubonic plague originated in China. And it explains how and why it originated in China and how it spread. In fact, it started in China, then it spread towards Western Europe along the Silk Road, which in turn led to Africa and in turn led to the rest of the world. The plague came to the United States from China via Hawaii in the late 19th century. So there's a long history of China being the key transmission, not only the key original source of these viruses, the most dangerous pandemics and plagues in American and world history, but of being the means of transmitting it across the globe. Because the policy choices, not only does their certain aspects of their culture and their geography make it a perfect petri dish for these pandemics and plagues originating, their policy choices, poor policy choices, frequently lead to it being transmitted at a high rate. The first known case of coronavirus traced back to November in China, according to this article from Live Science. A 55-year-old individual from Hubei province in China may have been the first person to have contracted COVID-19, the disease that caused the new COVID-19 spreading across the globe. The case, according to the South Morning China Post, the case dates all the way back to November 17th, 2019. That is months, in fact, more than 2 months before China would admit this had any problem to the rest of the world. Two critical months that if we had taken action, that action could have suppressed and stopped this from expanding and spreading across the globe. What about that Spanish flu that's been called the Spanish flu for a range of reasons? Well, what if historians discovered about it? The 1918 flu that spread in 1918, then again in 1919, then again in 1920, the most serious influenza in the last century in terms of its global impact, and that killed nearly 700,000 people here in the United States, which, given the population size today, would equate to millions today. Well, according to this article published in National Geographic, the 1918 flu pandemic that killed 50 million worldwide originated in China, historians say. The global flu outbreak of 1918, for decades, science have debated where it came from, but increasing data and information, according to the historian Mark Humphreys at Canada's Memorial University, show that newly unearthed records confirm that one of the side stories of the war, the mobilization of 96,000 Chinese laborers to work behind British and French lines of World War I's Western Front, may have been the likely source of the pandemic. Again, certain culinary habits, certain cultural habits, and then certain policy responses often frequently lead to these pandemics originating from China. Of note there, once again, that's a case where illegal immigration or too much immigration leads to the spread of disease. This has been a concern of people like Michael Savage for a long time. It has been a concern of people allowing too much illegal immigration into the United States that's unchecked, unvetted, and not met, and undemocratic. Doesn't go through the democratic protocols and procedures that we've agreed to put into place to regulate and govern the terms, scale, and scope of immigration into the United States. The same fear, the same worry, the same concern that viruses may be infected as well. Not just crime, not just lower job and labor markets, not just stress on low-income and working-class communities in terms of infrastructure, in terms of housing, in terms of schools, but not only all of that, potentially viruses coming because people are not being checked for health reasons. That may have been the entire reason for the Spanish flu, again, originating to certain culinary and cultural habits in the unique hot pandemic hotspot of China. Now, what about the 1968 pandemic? Well, I can tell you what this used to be called until the Center for Disease Control and others started scourging their site of any relevant references. This was called the Hong Kong flu. This was the most violent, most vicious flu to hit the United States until the COVID-19 virus. Over 100,000 killed. That it was called, and where did it originate? Once again, there was a reason why it was called the Hong Kong flu, because it originated in China. And again, what does this correlate to? Well, let's go back to those wild wet markets. COVID-19, according to this article headline, COVID-19, China's wild wet markets, pangolins and bats. Maybe it's them. And it goes into sort of detail about how China's wet markets are a perfect petri dish for the spread of viruses. By the way, still today in this article headline, happened long months after the virus spread, Chinese wet markets still selling bats. China and its exotic animal wet markets are, quote, according to this article in USA Today, incubators of human diseases like coronavirus. And yet for decades, they have refused to correct, remedy, or restrict the scale or scope of wet markets in the sale of these kind of animals. I was in Hong Kong some years ago, and going through the food markets, you could literally buy anything of everything. They once served me pigeon soup at one of the high-end hotels at the Peninsula Hotel, beautiful hotel down in the sort of old British part of Hong Kong. And in the middle of the pigeon soup was a pigeon's head. This is sort of the culinary mindset of the cultural mentality of aspects of China, which pose constant continuous health risks to the rest of the world and have for centuries, unless we take meaningful remedial action now. Chinese admits, by the way, the Chinese government, back in 2003, after the SARS epidemic broke out, they admitted they actually made a bunch of mistakes governing SARS, and yet they didn't take sufficient corrective remedial action to prevent this from happening again. So even if we take the Chinese government face value, we say they had no knowledge of the lab, there was no lab connection to this, there was no deliberate or malevolent attempt to have anything released, there was no accidental release from a lab, hey, it just happened in its wet markets. That is no less an indictment of China and its policies, because China has known of that risk for centuries and centuries and centuries, and yet failed to take remedial action. You would think after the Black Plague, after the Asian flu of 1958, there's a reason they call it the Asian flu, after what was really a Chinese-originated Spanish flu in 1918, after the Hong Kong flu of 1969, after SARS in 2003, maybe they would have learned their policy lessons about how to restrict the transmission of viruses so they don't become worldwide pandemics and plagues. Maybe they would have learned about changing certain cultural culinary traditions and educating their populace about their risk in order to prevent and preclude people from doing this in the future and spreading it in the future. Yet they still failed. They still refused. So the best version of China, still has China being extremely negligent to the degree of gross negligence, of deliberate recklessness, which in our criminal law is an indictable offense. In talking about some of the consequences of what's happening with the virus, we have headlines like today, U.S. oil benchmark goes negative for the first time after 300% price plummet related to the economic collapse that is occurring due to public policy reaction to this virus. Studies show 800,000 Americans could die from shutdown-related suicides due to social isolation, due to economic depression, due to other side effects of this virus, independent of and separate from the virus itself. A study out of the United Kingdom today said that more people will likely die from not getting timely cancer treatment due to the shutdown than will occur from the virus itself. Whether you attribute that to governmental policy or the viruses, either way, China is the reason why we're here. Without China doing what they did, we're not here, period. A Nobel Prize winner says that the coronavirus had to have come from a lab, explaining the details about that. I have friends and connections in the medical community who've said they have seen, know people who have seen the testing for the virus, and their concern is that it could be or was man-made, and that that triggered a higher, more intense policy response, because the fear was that if it was man-made, who knows how it would react? Maybe it wouldn't react like a typical virus. And this may be part of the reason for the political overreaction by some of our public policy health officials, if it turns out that is true. Either way, we have a long-standing, long history of problems with China. People are saying maybe we're going to be at war with China. In reality, for two decades, China has been at war with us. Just in January, from this headline from the Department of Justice, Harvard University professor and two Chinese nationals charged in three separate China-related cases concerning espionage activities in China. Meanwhile, you have people like the Facebook coronavirus fact checker. Facebook chooses as its fact checker someone who works as connections to Duke University, who in turn had connections to the Wuhan virus lab, where it's alleged that the may have some connection to this virus in some manner. Maybe it was there and deliberately leaked. Maybe it was there and was accidentally leaked. Maybe it has some ties, maybe some sort of experimentation that was occurring there in some manner ended up impacting whatever was out there that got spread. We won't know, because China will never likely be truthful, forthcoming, or honest. But the person, quote unquote, fact checking it is someone that is compromised in terms of conflicts of interest, because they have ties to that very lab. In fact, if you go further and deeper into the connections, you're going to find a lot of connections between China and Duke. But we'll come back to that a little bit later. Let's talk about the economic espionage and economic war that China has been waging on us for two decades. As this article is entitled from The Economist, Made in China, Asia's dominance in manufacturing will endure. And what it goes through is it shows how just about 20 years ago, in fact, 30 years ago, go back to 1990, China had about less than 4% of the global manufacturing market. The United States, close to a quarter of the global manufacturing market. Today, the United States is dipping below 15%, and China is getting close to 30%, almost a tenfold increase in that time period of China monopolizing the global manufacturing market, leading to a collapse of jobs and wages in the United States and the Western world. To give some example, China produces 80% of the world's air conditioners, 70% of its mobile phones, 60% of its shoes. Indeed, as we've learned, China actually makes in some cases all or most of things like masks, of things like various necessary medical goods for the production needed to fight the virus, for various medical supply, critical infrastructure items for medical supply, for national security, for information technology, for manufacturing, increasingly monopolized and controlled or dominated by China. That becomes a national security risk, a public health risk, not just economic risk, as China has continued to be for the last three decades. Indeed, as this article goes into detail, how China weaponized its supply chain. When the coronavirus emergency transitions to a post-COVID-19 economic order, securing the critical needs of supply chains was undermined by China's political decision-making. In homes and hospitals across the country, Canadians and Americans are asking and encountering the existential threat that authoritarian forces pose to their lives. What they didn't realize is those authorities were coming from Beijing. Due to Beijing, for example, Beijing went about monopolizing the production and supply of masks and other necessary protective personal equipment that they knew would be essential and fundamental in the virus that they helped spread, that they facilitated the transmission of, and that they covered up the disclosure of knowledge and information about. If China's willing to do that in a public health crisis that they helped create, what do you think they'll do in a true national security crisis? What do you think they'll do in an economic crisis? This is the problem with allowing China to manipulate and monopolize large parts of our manufacturing economy and society. Here's just another article about how infectious diseases continue to emerge from Chinese wet markets. The zoonotic origins of severe respiratory viral infections. This was prior. This is all the way back in 2006. So China knew that they were a petri dish for the spread of pandemics and yet took no action to remedy it or stop it. And when it occurred on their watch, what did they do? They took special efforts to make sure the world didn't know about it while they monopolized key and critical supplies and equipment concerning it. Here's another article in virology that you can find at Science. Extensive diversity of coronaviruses in bats from China. This is talking about how there's so many different kinds of coronaviruses that are from the bats in China, that their transmission is at a uniquely high risk rate in China due to Chinese cultural and culinary traditions and other geopolitical issues related to China, and that they thus pose a unique particular risk of pandemic or plague-like harm to the rest of the world. Yet China took no remedial or protective action for decades and, in fact, facilitated the transmission and spread of it while monopolizing the supply of necessary public health equipment to protect, which when they further dug in, it turned out much of their equipment that they created in many instances was not even adequate or sufficient to protect people's health. But this is not all that China has been busy monopolizing. Here's an article from CoinDesk. Inside China's plan to have global denomination of blockchain. This involves about how many Chinese companies or individuals are involved in mining Bitcoin. This involves how China is involved in trying to control and monopolize digital currencies and in the economy. That is just one of the examples. Here's another list, a list of the Chinese spy cases in the United States. And this was just over a limited time period. And you go through the list and it's one after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next. And these are just people who got caught. Indeed, they have over 35 listed cases of Chinese espionage efforts against the United States in just the last half decade. Meanwhile, our U.S. corporations have been in bed with China, from Boeing to Nike. Here's just one of the headlines. Nike sweatshops in China, about underage workers and underpaid employees. That Just Do It meant a command to effective slave labor. That same pattern of worrying about what's happening with China expands to things like this headline. New Jersey City is deploying a Chinese firm's drones to enforce social distancing. So not only is China influencing and impacting and infecting our information technology and its security, they're at the same time creating and exporting the surveillance mechanisms, the social credit system, to monitor activities here in the United States. By the way, the kind of viruses that can spread from China, well, this is just another article headline. New Ebola-like virus found in a Chinese bat's liver. This is the problem with having ongoing in-depth relationships with China that do not put American safety and security first. Here's another headline. Companies can't stop labor abuses at Chinese factories. Talking about the complicity of Chinese companies in manipulation and support of repression and suppression of religious and speech rights in China. An article even from National Republic Review, no less, how China's one-child policy led to forced abortions and 30 million bachelors. Another headline article from Capital Report, China really is to blame for millions of lost U.S. manufacturing jobs. Another headline article about China, if you go to any of the constitutional liberties we care about, if you talk about any of the human rights that we as Americans care about, if you talk about any of the economic freedom that matters to Americans, if you talk about any aspect of national security, healthcare security, information security, the number one threat to the United States and everything it holds dear is China. As just one example of that, China forcefully harvests organs from detainees, tribunal concludes. This is from NBC. If you have followed at all the Epoch Times, it's a publication founded by a group of people who have been targeted for in China for their religious expression, their religious activities, including deliberately target the killing, the murder, the imprisonment, and the harvesting of organs of people simply because China doesn't like their religious beliefs. This is who China is. And who's in bed with him? Not only major U.S. corporations, not only the Bush family, the Biden family, the Clinton family, and key political actors in the United States, but people like Duke University. It probably wasn't a coincidence that you had one person that kept popping up in these different reports. So when they looked at who it was that did the fact-checking report for Facebook to say that, no, even a report from the Associated Press is unreliable and is not true and can't be trusted if it says anything bad about China and viruses and the spread of this virus, particularly its man-made creation potential and other issues worthy of investigation, many of the same people involved in that fact-check show up with connected to Duke University, employed by Duke University and its various Asian outposts. Those same people often show up as working at the Wuhan virus lab that's in question and is at issue. The same people often involved or the same connection to Duke keeps reoccurring when you're talking about developing the vaccine for the viruses. The same Duke University connections start popping up when you talk about who the first tests were designed to test for these viruses. So you have people that may have been involved or implicated or connected to the lab that may have created the virus, to people who are supposedly creating the testing for the virus, to those supposedly creating the vaccine for the virus, connected over increasingly back, coming back over and over. There's like one little sort of anchor to the, all of these lines that are around it are people connected to Duke University. Duke University, in fact, has one of the biggest universities connected to China. DKU is what they call it, is a bet on the future of China. The Kunshan Report. And this is about Duke's effort to create Duke Kunshan University in China. With over 40 talking about their expansive involvement in China, their connection to China, how they considered part of the Belt and Road Initiative with China, Global China from Empire to Nation. These are some of the courses that are being taught at the Duke University outpost in China. In fact, the Duke Global Education Office talks about the Duke Kunshan University connections, how it's a partnership between Duke University and Wuhan University. Wuhan. That just pops right back up again in the Kunshan Jiangsu province, and talking about the connection and the deep ties between Duke and these institutions that end up having people that are connected to the folks that are trying to design vaccines, the people that are doing the testing, the people that have connections to the viral lab, people that have the connections to trying to clear China and immunize China and inoculate China from public criticism. And of course, if you dig deeper, you will find ties, not surprisingly, to the Gates Foundation, which is a donor to a wide range of these organizations and groups. This is part of sort of the consistent, continuous pattern and habits that of China and how they have compromised and infected the American political process, how they have diseased our core American political institutions so that they are not protecting people in the United States, not protecting our safety, not protecting our security, not protecting our economy, not protecting our democracy, not protecting the core of who we are as human beings in the United States. China continues to be the real threat. That while there's always been talk of Russia and talk of and about the Middle East and talk about Venezuela or other parts of the world, the only place that has dozens of espionage charges brought every year is China. That's not a coincidence. That's not a chance. That's not circumstance. That's a causative relationship of consequence. And when we come back, we'll be talking about someone who has in-depth understanding of China, who has been warning about China now for half a decade. That is Jack Posobiec. So come back with us as we'll be talking with Jack about the problem that China poses and what policy solutions may be the cure. So come back right after the break. Welcome back to American Countdown. We're going to be up with Jack Posobiec. I met Jack all the way back in the 2016 campaign. We were at the deplorable together right after the election, back during the sort of inaugural era and the hope and optimism that came with it. The president has been resisting China in his own way throughout his 3 years, but not necessarily everybody in the State Department has always shared that agenda. Now it seems like more and more people are. But Jack had a long history before that, before he was at the Rebel, before he was now at One America News Network. He's been across the political and economic scene. Part of that included work all the way back in China and understanding how China operated its mindset and mentality. And probably in part for that reason, amongst others, was one of the early warners of the risk that this pandemic posed to the United States and the rest of the world, as well as the China model of interaction and an economic and political espionage that continues to be an ongoing threat. So glad you could be with us, Jack.
Robert, thanks so much for having me on. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely. So can you give people some of your background as to why you have a particular understanding and an appreciation of China, its policies, its politics, its economics, its sort of global interaction that gave you, put you in a position to be an early warner of the risk that this pandemic posed?
Right. So I've been traveling China on and off for the past 15 years. Originally went over as part of a sort of school trip when I was an undergrad at Temple University. Then I eventually did a study abroad there. And that turned into me basically moving to China and staying. I didn't walk in my graduation. I actually ended up getting a job with the American Chamber of Commerce and staying back. I stayed, ended up living in China for about 2 years. Didn't only stay in Shanghai. I went all over the entire country. So I learned the language. I was taking intensive language courses. After those 2 years, I came back to the United States and immediately applied for and eventually became a member of U.S. Navy intelligence. And during my time in Navy intelligence, I was a Mandarin linguist, but I was also studying what was going on. Obviously, there's more of a military focus there, but understanding what was going on in terms of their politics, in terms of their leadership, in terms of how their interactions with the world are informed by their mental model of the world and how things should be. So obviously, South China Sea was a major flashpoint of something that really broke out 2013, 2014, that we looked at very closely. And so an understanding of this background, an understanding of sort of the mind of Chinese leadership is really what it takes to inform, I think, an analysis of where we think people are going. You know, if anyone's seen the movie Midway, probably one of the most famous Navy intelligence officers or the most esteemed Navy intelligence officers of all time, Commander Edwin Layton, later Admiral Edwin Layton, is featured prominently. He's kind of the star of the movie. He was a person who spent years in Japan, learned to speak fluent Japanese, who had met with the Japanese admirals back in the 30s, and then coming forward, he was the one who predicted the Pearl Harbor attack. He wasn't listened to at the time, of course, and we know how the history played out. But then he also correctly predicted the Midway attack. It was Midway that then, of course, allowed America to win and get the turning point in the war. So it's that, it shows how that cultural understanding, that deep understanding can lead to success for America. And we're going to need people who are like Edwin Layton, who are following in his footsteps as we turn to yet another threat emanating from Asia. This time, of course, Japan is our ally, but the threat this time is coming from that massive land power there in China.
Well, exactly. I mean, to a certain degree, China may have been the first empire to dominate the world had the emperor not chosen to burn his ships. So it's always been a country that, due to its geopolitical size, due to its geopolitical location, due to its sort of political idolatry, has a sort of imminent threat for global domination. What China's doing in Africa, what China's doing in Latin America, the degree to which they have tied those countries to China to make them dependent effectively, codependent effectively on China, a codependency that may be enhanced with this spread of this pandemic as their economies collapse. Could you explain to people the degree to which China has sort of used its non-military, its soft power to create a real global dominance and an ongoing threat to American independence and freedom around the world?
Well, Robert, it's so astute of you to point out that at one point China really did rule the world, or at least their corner of the world. In fact, the name for China, that's of course the English term, which comes from traders and people who had met with them early on. But in Chinese, in Mandarin, the phrase they use or the term they use for China is Zhongguo. Zhongguo means central kingdom, the kingdom of the center. And this really informs a sort of thought process within Chinese political science called Zhongguoism or central kingdomism. There is a trend, certainly among the hardliners, but even as among many of the moderates, that it is their duty, it is their right, it is their mandate that they should be atop the world order. Because, and for, you know, about 1,000 years in Asian history, China was the center. They were the center of economics, they were the center of philosophy, the center of finance, the central military power, the center of technology. And they ruled over most of Asia as vassal states. You know, they had a very much a big brother, little brother relationship when it came to Japan. And as every big brother, little brother knows, that at some point in that relationship, little brother comes along to go beat up on big brother. That's too, to put it in, you know, in an analogy. So what China is doing now in terms of spreading their wealth, spreading their ability, spreading their influence across the world, they've been focused on really two lanes of this. One is through, as you mentioned, soft power, which I tend to think their soft power comes more through cultural institutions. If you look at the way that China has heavily invested into Hollywood, if you look at the way China has heavily invested into Western and American think tanks, such as the Brookings Institute, which at one point was taking a contract from Huawei to spread. And this is seen as one of the most prestigious think tanks in Washington, D.C. I mean, they credential national security advisors. This is the Brookings Institute. This is extremely prestigious. They were taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from China. Our movies, our financial infrastructure, how many times do you see China being the good guy in the movies? Or why is it that, you know, the bad guy is never some, you know, rogue Chinese general? I mean, certainly during the Cold War, we had all sorts of, we had Rocky IV, talking about the Soviet Union. We had Red Dawn. We have lots of movies about this. But in this term around, China is always the positive one, right? The movie 2012, China comes by and saves the world. So, but to get to your earlier point, China's instituted a program called One Belt, One Road. And nominally, what China claims they're attempting to do through this is to sort of recreate the Silk Road. The Silk Road, of course, being the ancient pathway between Asia, Eurasia, and China that connected the two across the area of Xinjiang, where they've got a million people, a million Uyghurs in detention camps, is a huge part of that. But really what China is also doing is something that I like to call debt trap diplomacy. And debt trap diplomacy, which they've been conducting across Latin America, across Africa, essentially the way it works is they come to a country and they say, in the third world, and they say, we'd love to build you roads. We'd love to build you railroads. We'd love to build you ports, all sorts of infrastructure, anything that they can do to build them. And they say, well, if you can't afford it, don't worry. We'll extend you lines of credit. We'll extend you lines of credit. And then inevitably, and when it comes back that the country is unable to pay back the loan, China says, well, that's perfectly fine. Just sign over some of these mineral rights for your rare earth elements, sign over some of these natural resources. And of course, in terms of those ports, well, yes, of course, China will be able to get free basing rights for their naval destroyers, for their naval cruisers, potentially their aircraft carrier if they can never get the thing working out of the South China Sea. So they're looking at ways to really make these countries completely beholden to them through debt. And really debt trapping. And this is something that they've now taken to the next level when they're looking at Europe as they start to dig in Europe and make their inroads there. But it's not so much the debt trapping as they're doing. What they're doing is expanding their 5G access through the Huawei platform. This is something, and for people who say, oh, that's, you know, that's crazy, China would never do that. The UK, right, the United Kingdom, we're talking about the country that at one point was the British Empire, the country that defeated the Chinese Empire just about 150 years ago in the Opium Wars, now is turning around and saying they need China to build infrastructure throughout the United Kingdom. This is the UK 5G network. Now, Boris Johnson and other British leaders have finally, in the wake of the coronavirus, said that they're looking at potentially revisiting that relationship. And I think that's accurate because being the United Kingdom, the U.S. has a very close relationship with the Anglosphere, which also includes intelligence sharing. This is done through something called the Five Eyes Agreement. For anyone who followed Spygate, you guys remember Five Eyes. So what happens then if the United States' closest partner in terms of signals intelligence, communications intelligence, and everything that we knew from the NSA databases and the mass bulk collection that's done, what happens when our closest partner in Five Eyes has their infrastructure literally built by the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese regime? I mean, this would be like having the KGB coming by and saying, sure, we'd love to lay some communications cables for you, comrade. No problem. No, this is something that's completely unacceptable. It's absolutely untenable. So for the United States to be able to continue to have that relationship, and it does seem as though UK is obviously they've become more Eurosceptic. They're now turning away from the EU, hopefully turning towards that idea of an Anglosphere. This is something that obviously flies in the face of that. But at the same time, we have to also look at continental Europe and our NATO allies there and whether or not they will have Chinese intrusion piggybacking on any of our security infrastructure.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you see it, like, there's a headline from Business Insider in a related capacity because everybody started using Zoom as a way. Almost every court, including highly confidential court proceedings that were sealed proceedings in criminal cases, family law cases, protective trade secret cases, cases where for very compelling public policies and only the most compelling public interest allows a court to seal proceedings, almost all of these courts decided to shut down except to use Zoom for the purposes of conducting their court hearings, taking evidence and the rest. And then we have headlines like this one from Business Insider. Zoom admits that calls sort of just mistakenly got routed through China, and the connected problems with Zoom. And then we have various city and county governments deciding to use Chinese drones to monitor citizens out in the public. And aside from just the completely crazy dystopian vision of a drone watching you and talking to you like they were in New York, why are we using Chinese technology to do mass public surveillance on our own citizens using government law enforcement, knowing that that information can and likely will be relayed to China, seems extraordinary. So it's, and then when you add to that the problems we've had with Chinese hacking, the problems we've had with Chinese espionage in the intellectual property world. I mean, when I was there, and this was 15 years ago, there was clearly no respect within China for intellectual property of the West, period. I could buy any movie I wanted for 99 cents at the local Hong Kong market. But you take that to this, you scale that up to a government with the power of China and the reach of China, and watching the use of Chinese technology in the same way they've infected aspects of our culture, infected aspects of, they learned how American politics work. It's through think tanks and big political family groups like the Clintons and the Bushes of the world, that if you get influence through the think tanks, you get influence through Hollywood, you get influence through the universities. That's what we have, Harvard. It's not, you know, San Jose State, whose professor is getting arrested for doing Chinese espionage or other corrupt activities connected to China. It's Harvard University's head of the chemistry department that's getting indicted and pled guilty last month because the evidence was so overwhelming.
And speaking not only in terms of that, but I've publicly called for a banning of the TikTok app on platforms in the United States.
And could you explain to people the connection between TikTok and China? Because I don't think most people, like, you know, my son, other people, they had no clue of this. They're just getting this technology, this culture, this Right. Everything that's bombarded to them, not realizing what's embedded in it is effectively either Chinese control or Chinese propaganda.
Right. So what TikTok can do is, even when you're not using it on your phone, it has the ability. And by the way, it's not the only app that can do this. Certainly,
right.
Certainly almost every app can do this. They have the ability to see and track everything that's done on your phone. That information is, though, in this case, is being sent back to China. Now, they claim, of course, that even though TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, they claim that the servers are held outside of China and that there's no chance they would ever share that data with the servers that they have inside China. The Chinese version of TikTok, by the way, which is actually a slightly different platform called Douyin, is actually more advanced than the international version that they have called TikTok that goes out. One feature they have on this is embedded facial recognition technology. So as you're watching a video, oh, if it's your favorite TikTok star, if it's someone that you like, you can click their face, and then immediately what will pop up is a way to track every single video on the platform that person appears in. So when we're talking about Chinese political influence and Chinese business influence and the fact that it's children in many of these cases that are using these platforms, what then happens if I throw this scenario out as a former intelligence officer, what then happens if Chinese Ministry of State Secrets, the MSS, their intelligence arm, is then able to track, and they obviously can do this quite quickly, to find out if leaders, right, key leaders have children that are using these platforms, then they're able to save messages, they're able to save private messages, they're able to save private videos, right? Your Snapchat goes away, but your MSS agent might still have it. So then they can easily turn around and say, you do what we want, or we're going to release this video of your kids. We're going to make it very hard for them. And, you know, whether it's embarrassing or, you know, potentially something illegal, who knows, right? So the issue is there's massive privacy concerns on one hand, but also there's massive influence concerns that we really need to be very careful with if we are going to allow these platforms that are easily, and at this point, quite frankly, we can't assume anymore. And this is just writ large in this entire process, right? Talking about the pandemic, but of course, talking about the fentanyl that comes from China, the opioid crisis. We can't take China at their word anymore. We tried. We tried allowing China into the global community. We tried allowing them into the WTO to act as a responsible actor, right? Responsible rise. That's what we heard from the Bushes and the Clintons all throughout the 2000s, responsible rise. We've now given them their shot, and we've seen the lies. We've seen the cover-ups. We've seen the failures to let us know exactly what's going on with this virus, right? We can't even figure out what the sequence is, what proper sequences and strains of this thing are, because we can't figure out the origins of this thing. Why? Because China covered the entire thing up. And so we can't take China at their word anymore. We have to treat them as a bad faith actor. And that's period. And I don't mean to say that in the sense that I think China is angling towards war with the United States, but China views us as a competitor that they want to take down a peg, and they want to be where the United States is in the world order. They want the United States down. They want to be up. And they will use their entire society, not just the government, not just the military, not just the espionage, not just the economics, the entire society to be able to accomplish this.
Exactly. Could you explain to people how the collectivist, conformist, cover-up culture of Chinese government and society is critical to understanding not only how the pandemic spread, but also why they are so untrustworthy moving forward in any aspect of economic, social, or national security life?
Yeah, sure. So China, more so than many other Asian countries, but certainly an aspect of Asian countries, is the concept of face. This concept is not very well understood in the United States or in the West, because in the West, we praise honesty, we praise integrity. In the East, and understanding the Eastern mind is key to this, they understand, they praise and uphold face. So when there is a problem, when there is something that's gone wrong with one of their institutions, when a leader has an issue, the goal then becomes how to re-maintain face or restore face to that person. If you cause someone to lose face, you are the one who has committed fault. If you're pointing out someone's issue, if you're pointing out that someone was late, if you're pointing out someone owes you money, you are losing face, not the person who is actually at fault. What is the issue? How does this come up with the United States? Well, the entire structure of Chinese society, as it has been currently been structured in the past 50 or so years, 50 plus, 70 years almost since the founding of the Chinese communist regime, is constructed around perpetuation, survival of that regime, of uniting that regime with the Chinese people. Remember, this is a key phrase, and if you follow China for long enough, you'll hear Chinese propaganda speakers or their outlets, they'll always use this phrase, you've harmed the feelings of the Chinese people. You've probably heard that phrase, right?
Yes.
You've harmed the feelings of the Chinese people. It doesn't make sense to us. Could you imagine Barack Obama say, when you've harmed the feelings of the American people? It's like, what are you talking about? But to them, they don't view any separation between the party, between the state, between the citizens, between the workers, students, military, etc. They view, and again, this is the collectivist mindset. It is completely separate from our more individualist mindset. They are hyper-collectivist in the sense that we in the West can have a tendency to be hyper-individualist. They view all of these different facets of life as connected. And Xi Jinping is the first Chinese chairman to really maintain that mantle of a cult of personality. He has centralized power more than any Chinese chairman since Chairman Mao. A lot of these guys in the past have been more technocratic. Hu Jintao, total technocrat. Jiang Zemin, was very much technocrat. Deng Xiaoping obviously had a lot to do with restoration, but then he stepped back. Remember, Deng Xiaoping never took an official title. I think other than he was like the international, or the national chairman of the Chess Foundation of China or something officially, even though, of course, he's the supreme leader. And responsible for Tiananmen Square. We can't forget that. And so looking at what Xi Jinping has done, and Xi Jinping is the first chairman of the Chinese Party, Communist Party, to be a member of the princelings. And what are the princelings? The princelings are the children of the original senior members of Chairman Mao's Communist Party. the Long Marchers, if you understand that much about Chinese history, when they were forced out of the respectable part of China by the nationalists prior to World War II. And so having that background and having that claim to, you know, fame in sort of a very communist sense, the princelings are now in charge of the party, but they're also in charge of business. They're in charge of military. And there are different factions within there, but they have aligned in a very, if you watch Game of Thrones, it becomes easier to sort of track Chinese politics because they still operate that. And in some cases with that level of brutality, Xi Jinping has been willing to take down all of his opponents, regardless of how powerful they are, regardless of the size of the cities that they control, the different party bosses. If he sees you as a potential rival, if he sees you as an opponent, he will disappear you. He will throw you out. He will get rid of you. And so he's taking face to the next level, to the point where he has now conflated that idea of the Chinese community behind himself. Now, there is a possibility then, because of the issues caused by this pandemic, not only in terms of the human cost, but also in terms of the massive economic cost of what China has already lost, billions of dollars, but potentially even more if China does actually move into decoupling with Western nations as people seek to move their manufacturing away from China, try to decentralize our supply chain so we don't get into this very stupid situation, again, by having all of our eggs in one basket. Xi Jinping has a cult of personality that could easily backfire against him because of the religious persecution, because of the persecution of Christians, the house Christians, Falun Gong, the Uyghurs, because of what he's done in Hong Kong. We saw the massive uprising against him there because of his treatment of Taiwan, et cetera, the list goes on.
Can you explain to some degree also sort of the background of the degree to which China uses North Korea and how a lot of even, you know, Trump's efforts towards North Korea really are dealing with China as well? Because I think the press does a good job of completely suppressing the degree to which China and North Korea are interdependent.
So North Korea would not, I mean, their regime would collapse without China, without the backing of China. Their regime would collapse in short order without China being providing them with food, providing them with capital. I mean, they are completely cut off. They're referred to sometimes as the hermit kingdom because they're so completely isolated. And so actually prior to his ascension to power, Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il traveled from Pyongyang to Beijing on a train. So Kim Jong-il never left North Korea. Kim Jong-un very rarely leaves North Korea, but they went to Beijing. Why did they do that? Just key. Because they went to get the blessing from the emperor. Kim Jong-il was in ill health at the time, pun intended, that Kim Jong-un would be the successor. They are China's pit bull on a leash. And whenever China wants us to jump, whenever China wants us to get worried, they pull on that chain and North Korea shoots off some rockets as they've done recently, or they'll conduct a missile test. They are the attack dog that China uses so that China doesn't have to get hit with that.
Exactly. When we come back after the break, we'll have one last question for Jack. What should the president do? What does he expect the president to do? What about the foreign, the immunity given to foreign sovereigns that's allowing China to be immune from what they did here? Can that change? Should it change? Will it change? So come back after the break. We'll have that one last question for Jack. And then in the bottom half of the hour, we'll take your questions as you, the jury, get to call in and asking about what you want to know. And we'll give you the best answers that we can. So come back right after the break. Welcome back to American Countdown. We'll be taking your calls in the bottom half of the hour. You can call in at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. If you're calling internationally, you can call your country code 512-646-1776. That's 512-646-1776. We'll take your calls in the bottom half of the hour. We have one last question for Jack, and that's part of it. You know, there's finally discussions about removing the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that got passed in 1976, which basically made all foreign governments immune from suit in the United States, even if they do deliberately harmful things. Now, they've carved out some exceptions here and there along the way, certain forms of money laundering, certain forms of terrorism. But right now, the most legal analyst presumption is that unless you can show the Chinese government was engaged in commercial activity, that all of the other bad things they did related to this pandemic, suppression of information, false information, punishing their own whistleblowers who were trying to disclose information to the world, misleading information to and through the World Health Organization, that there's really no doubt from an evidentiary perspective that but for what China did, we're not here. We don't have this many deaths. We don't have this kind of policy response to the risk that the pandemic poses. None of this is here. The economy doesn't collapse, but for China lying and hiding and not disclosing information, not bringing in the CDC to help out right away, et cetera. Given that, do you think Congress will actually take action and finally change that? And what else do you think the president can do, should do, and will do to put us on a different course vis-a-vis China, so that not only does this health risk not pose a permanent, ongoing, continuous risk, but that there's no such future risk either from national security in terms of economic activity, in terms of manufacturing independence, in terms of supply chain safety, et cetera.
Well, Robert, I do know that we've covered on One American News that Congress has already, I believe it was Lance Gooden, along with several other co-sponsors, did introduce a bill that would do just that, that would repeal the foreign sovereign immunity for China, simply because their government cannot be separated from these, as you say, they cannot be separated from these actions. They cannot be separated from these various degrees of their society. So that bill was written with the idea of Western countries that are set up similar to how ours is, but simply doesn't apply to China. And I think, quite frankly, we are going to need a separate bill or separate type of legal framework for even looking at China, because their country is so different from ours. Secondly, and really the more broad part of the question, is what can the president do? Well, actually quite a bit the president can do and direct government to do. And I think one of the ideas that I've heard very prominently spoken about here in Washington, D.C. right now, sort of among the China Hawk community, is defaulting on all debt that the United States owes to China, and simply doing that as a down payment on the reparations that China is going to owe us for the economic damage and the human damage that they've caused to us throughout this entire situation, not only because of the pandemic, but also because of their fentanyl and their lack of actually doing anything to stop the flow of fentanyl to the United States. And of course, probably working with the cartels to get it across our borders. So looking at that from a purely financial perspective, that's number one. Number two is looking at whether or not China still is deserving and worthy of their most favored nation status with us in terms of trade. Now, obviously the tariffs, ratcheting them up, has already worked very well for the president, has worked very well for this administration. Most favored nation status is yet another financial lever. The key to China is finance. And the United States, in large part, has been financing the rise of China, not only through trade, but also through financial direct investment, foreign direct investment into China since the 1970s, when it all started. Deng Xiaoping, again, was the one that first allowed that in. So the financial sort of leaders, our ruling class, they've been looking at China, they've been looking at Chinese growth. They've gotten very, very rich off of Chinese growth. That's something that you're not really going to be able to see much of a corporate response for, and certainly in terms of manufacturing, moving it out of China, diversifying, bringing as much back to the United States as possible. Not only does that certainly help us out for our own unemployment situation, it helps us out for our own economy. It starts bringing our wealth back to the United States. This is very clearly what President Trump was talking about when he ran in 2015, 2016. You could look at his statements. I do think it's funny. There were all those viral videos that Vice and all those other liberals were groups were making when they would splice all the times that Trump talked about China, and they would put some little video or music behind the whole thing, like supercut. But now you look back, and I think the American people are saying, you know what? Maybe he was onto something. And, you know, maybe I don't like his politics, maybe I don't like some of his other statements, but man, he really nailed it when it came to China. And this is the threat of a generation in terms of us, the United States. This is absolutely an existential threat to the United States. And this is something that we need to take as seriously or more seriously than the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
Exactly. Thanks a lot for being with us, Jack. You can find Jack at One America News Network. You can find him on Twitter and other forms of social media, Jack Posobiec. And you can follow him across the board. He's a great follower on China and a wide range of breaking issues around the world. Was one of the early warners about the risks of this pandemic, what it posed to us politically, economically, and in terms of our health. And his public policy recipes are ones that hopefully the president will act on because we need it. There's been no better time for America First than right now. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Thanks so much, Robert. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Indeed, that's what the president did run on. The president ran on an agenda of America First. What better time for America First than right here, right now? This pandemic, whichever side you're on in terms of what risk you believe it poses to us in terms of public health, it clearly represents a threat to our well-being, our economic well-being, our civil society, our constitutional liberties, whether you blame that on the pandemic itself or the politicians' reactions to the pandemic. But for the pandemic, we're not here. That provided the pretext for these politicians to act in the way that they did. And they were able to do so because China afforded that opportunity by suppressing information related to the existence of the pandemic, to the scope and scale and severity of its potential threat, which led other governments around the West to not fully know the scope and scale and severity of the risk because they didn't know what information to trust. They didn't know how to assess it. There was evidence and reason to believe it might be man-made. If it was man-made, then it might pose unique, peculiar, particularistic risks that we wouldn't otherwise be able to easily or access or understand or to know what the policy responses or reactions should be. So in that scale and in that context, China is clearly to blame in a wide range of levels. To give just one illustration of this, we have Tucker Carlson's effective summary of what the indictment of China is related to this pandemic. And that's just one piece of what China is culpable for. Let's look at video clip number 5.
We spent much of the day speaking to highly informed officials in the U.S. government, as well as seasoned specialists on China. And here's the picture that emerged from those conversations. First, many in the intelligence world with experience in China suspected right away that the story the Chinese government was telling about this virus was almost certainly a lie. The first indication of that was the torrent of obvious nonsense coming from official sources in Beijing. Now, initially, Chinese sources, you may remember this, claimed the virus had jumped from an obscure scaly animal called a pangolin, which was sold in the Wuhan wet market. But that explanation didn't make any sense. Wet markets are seafood markets. Pangolins are mammals. So for that matter, are bats. So in the face of skepticism at this explanation, the Chinese then blamed Italian Armed Forces personnel, who it turns out had been near Wuhan a few months before for the Military World Games. That's an international sporting event. The Italians must have brought the virus to China, the Chinese said. When the Italian government complained about that, the Chinese shifted the blame to the U.S. military. The American armed services and Western tourists must have infected Wuhan, the Chinese said. Meanwhile, as they were saying this, behind the scenes, Chinese officials were working frantically to destroy relevant evidence of where it actually came from. Doctors and journalists in Wuhan who raised uncomfortable questions about the virus disappeared. Some of them may have been murdered. At one point in January, scientists in Shanghai succeeded in sequencing the DNA from the virus. The information they gathered from that could have been crucial to researchers around the world who are trying to understand the virus and develop vaccines against it. In other words, the rest of us. But the Chinese government ordered that viral sample destroyed and the lab notes from that shredded. The scientists themselves were disciplined for daring to conduct this research and their lab was shut down. The Chinese government then quarantined the entire city of Wuhan. Up to 5 million people fled. But apparently relatively few of them were allowed to travel to Beijing, the Chinese capital. Instead, they flew to Western cities around the world. Now, to most in the United States, reactions to a crisis like this seem grotesque, really unimaginable. But to Mandarin speakers who follow China carefully and have for a long time, these were highly familiar moves. The first reflex of the Chinese government is always to lie in order to hide failure and avoid embarrassment. In 2003, for example, the Chinese government lied about the initial outbreak of SARS, another coronavirus. In July of 2011, two passenger trains traveling in opposite directions smashed into each other at high speed outside the Chinese city of Wenzhou. The trains collided on a railroad bridge. Four cars derailed and tumbled to the ground below. Within hours, authorities arrived with backhoes. They pushed the passenger cars into a pit and began covering them with dirt. By some accounts, there were still survivors inside at the time, inside the passenger cars. In their initial statements, Chinese officials claimed that a lightning strike had caused that crash. They later conceded under pressure that it was sloppiness and shoddy construction that were to blame. Chinese media, meanwhile, were ordered to ignore the crash entirely except, quote, for positive news or that news issued by authorities. This was the template for China's official response to the Wuhan virus. From the early days of the outbreak, Chinese diplomats around the world insisted there was no chance whatsoever the virus had come from a lab. They sometimes insisted this even when no one had asked them, as if they were reading from a script. It soon became very obvious what was going on. English language academic journals had raised for years questions about the safety standards in Wuhan bioresearch labs. An article in Nature, for example, from 2017, noted that, quote, some scientists outside China worry about pathogens escaping from the facility. Classified State Department cables a year later voiced the same concerns. Chinese scientists themselves publicly discussed working with extremely dangerous pathogens in Wuhan. As of today, says someone in a position to know, there is, quote, almost unanimous agreement in the American intelligence gathering agencies that the virus currently destroying much of the world emerged from a lab in Wuhan. Almost unanimous. That's a phrase almost never used to describe any conclusion coming out of the intel community. Government officials in this country have believed that for some time now. They've been unable to interest our media or our epidemiologists in writing about it. In recent weeks, analysts from the CIA, the NSA, and others have briefed staff at the New York Times about the origins of this virus, but the newspaper has still not reported their findings. At the same time, and this may be directly related, China has been waging an unremitting propaganda war on the subject. Chinese officials have tried to squelch all conversations about who might be responsible for this pandemic by inflaming the political sensitivities and race guilt of American elites. Watch this clip from early last month as the spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry tries to dictate how American press outlets describe the virus.
Certain media say this coronavirus is a China virus. This is extremely irresponsible, and we firmly oppose that.
Among the many ironies in what you just heard, even now, even today, the disease is widely referred to in China as the Wuhan virus. Our news outlets, meanwhile, almost always call it COVID-19. That term does not translate to Chinese. COVID-19 is the name devised by the World Health Organization back in January under influence from Chinese leaders who were anxious to deflect responsibility for it. Once they succeeded in removing any hint of origin from the name of the virus, the Chinese government launched a campaign to tar anyone who mentioned Wuhan as a dangerous racist. Quote, racism is not the right tool to cover your own incompetence, lectured Chinese state media when President Trump referred to the Wuhan virus. American media parroted that line almost precisely, as no doubt the Chinese expected they would.
The president referred to the coronavirus as a, quote, foreign virus. And I think it's going to smack, it's going to come across to a lot of Americans as smacking of xenophobia.
Xenophobic wartime Trump, where he thinks the only path now is to basically declare the virus public enemy number one, to paint it in somewhat racist terms.
The xenophobia and the racism in outbreak is such a common thing, and it is incredibly dangerous. It is problematic, and it is scary, and I just really want to call that out.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? Why do you keep using this? A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why.
Fools. But not a major victory for the Chinese government. Media outlets are relatively easy to corrupt given the low level of sophistication of the people who work there. The Chinese government had bolder aims than that. The Chinese instructed their employees and assets in the United States to exert influence on elected officials. For example, according to an informed U.S. government official, quote, Beijing has instructed diplomats in their consulate in San Francisco to work with American state and local officials and members of Congress to push back against anyone who gets too far out on blaming China for this. That's what they're doing. Apparently, it's working. Here's Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy on CNN earlier this week.
The reason that we're in the crisis that we are today is not because of anything that China did. It's not because of anything the WHO did. It's because of what this president did.
It's not because anything China did. Other members of Congress voiced similar views, often in eerily similar language. Barbara Lee of California, long considered a strongly pro-China voice, tweeted this to the president, quote, "Diseases don't have nationalities. China isn't to blame for you fumbling this crisis," end quote. On March 12th, Congresswoman Judy Chu of Los Angeles wrote this, quote, "China didn't unleash anything. A virus spread as viruses do. Blaming China and insisting on calling this the Wuhan virus, even though every medical expert said not to, is putting people's lives in danger. Stop politicizing this and put people first." Just the week before Chu wrote that, on March 6th, a man called Zhang Ping, who runs the Chinese consulate in Los Angeles, met with Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti about the American response to coronavirus. And he tweeted about it that day. He said this, quote, "Looking forward to working closely with the city of Los Angeles to address this common public health challenge and develop closer ties between our cities and peoples," end quote. Now, we have no idea what Ping and Garcetti talked about in that meeting that day. It would be interesting to know. We reached out today to a number of California lawmakers with a history of closeness to China. That includes senior Senator Dianne Feinstein, who once employed a Chinese spy, to see if they have spoken to Chinese officials recently. None of them responded to our calls. But it's not just happening in California. According to a study and a story reported by National Review, the head of the state Senate in Wisconsin recently received multiple emails from the wife of the Chinese consul general in Chicago. She asked him to propose a resolution praising China for its handling of the Wuhan virus outbreak. The entire story of how the government of China has successfully shaped our understanding of this pandemic, of the virus, as well as our response to it, may take years to tell. And in fact, it may never fully be told at all, though we promise to do our best on this show. But it is clear how China sees this pandemic. China doesn't see this simply or even primarily as a public health disaster in which thousands are dying. China sees this as part of a larger geopolitical struggle for control of the world. Most Americans still don't perceive that or understand the profound gravity of the stakes involved. But how could they? Our leaders have lied to us about it for years.
The China apologist that Tucker Carlson rightly calls out in that context is extraordinary. The fact that we have so many people in the West willing and eager to defend China's complicity in the spread of this pandemic. You don't have to believe that they, in fact, did it deliberately. You don't have to believe that it came, that it's man-made. You don't have to believe that there was any impact of its lab facilities on the spread of this pandemic to recognize China's culpability and complicity in the transmission and the spread of this pandemic. In a country and in a region that has been the source of almost every major pandemic or plague in world history, going back to the Black Death, going back to the plague, that's how far back China's complicity and China's role in this, due to either to its cultural beliefs, due to its culinary habits, due to its policy responses, due to its collectivist culture that cares more about cover up and saving face than it does about responsibility or accountability of the state to its people. A country and a governing system that believes it's the duty of its citizenry is to its state, not the state to its citizens. It's no surprise that this happened and this took place. So you have massive propaganda taking place on behalf of China to cover up and as part of this face-saving operation, as part of their face-saving culture, as Jack Posobiec described it. In articles like Science that says the Wuhan lab says there's no way coronavirus originated there. And then you go through the science, and the science simply does not support the degree to which the lab is saying they could not have been involved. Then you have articles talking about the relationship of Duke to China, including key members of Duke's university professorial staff having a role at that precise Wuhan lab, and then turning around and writing fact-checking articles for Facebook through a group called Certain Health and Other Marketing Groups that then have ties to China and people who support China politically. And in fact, actually worked at that lab while they're fact-checking what that lab is capable and able to do. And the truth about life at Duke Kunshan University that goes into the details of the relationship and how much it is a sort of pro-China and one of the first and foremost academic China foreign joint ventures in academics and in public health in the world. This is how China is infecting the American university and academia and ultimately our public health officials that come from that academia and university sectors. Both the new coronavirus and SARS outbreaks likely started in Chinese wet markets. And the only question is whether it has some relationship to the lab, whether it might have been created by the lab and accidentally released into the wet markets, or intentionally released in the wet markets, but not for the purposes that ultimately came about, or may have had some correlation or causative relationship due to the location of those labs in Wuhan as well. But they show the models of what, photos of what those markets look like. And they are disturbing and unsettling. This while the U.S. manufacturing was stripped bare and it's our healthcare critical supplies lost to China due to China's monopolies. There's a good article even from the Council on Foreign Relations admitting what Jack Posobiec was talking about, the China-North Korea relationship. As he aptly puts it, North Korea is very much the pit bull in China's backyard that it can use to scare and terrorize the world into complicity with pro-Chinese politics and policies. And to describe how much those policies undermine human relationships and human rights around the world, this is just one article about China's one-child policy. As the headline reads, "Women tied like pigs, forced abortions, part of China's one-child policy." Not only forced abortions, there were talks of Chinese babies floating in the Chinese rivers because they violated the one-child policy of China, which, by the way, was itself a reaction to people who were pushing overpopulation obsessive politics in the late 1960s, the kind of people that Bill Gates' father was attached to and that now Bill Gates is attached to. So there's a constant correlation between this Chinese value system and overpopulation obsession and the oppressive authoritarian regimes. The Treasury has designated China as a currency manipulator. This impacts our economic relationships, our financial relationships, the way in which foreign countries can become debtors or have correlation to the value of currency, both the U.S. dollar and the Chinese yuan. And there's the fact that we took that step was a good first step, but it's only one of many steps that need to be made. Revoke the most favored nation status. Don't pay back any debt owed to China as recognition, as Jack Posobiec talked about, of reparations that are due from China to us for this pandemic spread. And continue on that path of decoupling the United States from China for their opioid abuse and flooding the United States with fentanyl in their collaborative efforts with the Mexican drug cartels to influence, to infect our communities. The same communities that China helped destroy by stripping them of their manufacturing centers and their energy productive capabilities, they then turn around and flood with opioids while they stick Chinese influence propaganda in the local university, in the local politician, and in the local Hollywood film being broadcast on your local broadcast station. The SARS epidemic and its aftermath in China goes to the fact that China was aware that this pandemic could be recreated again, yet refused and failed to take the public policy remedies required and necessary. We ordered reparations after the Civil War. We ordered reparations or had some form of reparations after the Great War in 1812, the Revolutionary War, World War I, World War II. And almost every sort of international conflict that led to death or demise has been reparations by one side or the other. It is long overdue that China pay its reparations for what they've done over the last 25 years, but particularly piqued by this recent pandemic as the basis and predicate to now finally take action, as the trigger to finally pull on the public policies that are long needed in dealing with China. Scientific evidence indicates that the virus that causes COVID-19 is of natural origin, not the result of human engineering. Now, what's the source of this? The source of this is health feedback. Well, who is health feedback? Well, health feedback is actually part of that Facebook fact-checking organization, and the person writing and penning many of these articles is connected to those Duke institutions that have close ties to China, including particularly the people involved in actually working at the Wuhan lab over multiple years. This is how there's this interrelationship, this interdependency, this sort of collectivist culture of cover-up that is called face-saving in China in order to be able, that has influenced and infected America's intellectual institutions, America's cultural institutions, America's political institutions over two decades. That's why we, even though we called the flu the Asian flu when it came from Asia in 1958, why we called the Hong Kong flu the Hong Kong flu when it came here in 1968, why we called what we said the bubonic plague was ultimately originated from China and recognized its source, what we called the Ebola virus, because of its connection to the Ebola location in which it arose. all of a sudden we couldn't say the China virus? We couldn't say that suddenly, even though this virus originated from China, spread because of the politics and policies of the Chinese government, is here because of this, much more so than the Hong Kong flu or the Asian flu or the Spanish flu was the culpability or complicity of the Chinese government, even more so than the Black Plague was. And yet somehow we can't call this one that. That reflects the degree to which our American media institutions have been contaminated, have been infected with this virus of Chinese propaganda in the same way our academies have, our universities have, our Hollywood culture has, and our politicians have. Just go back and Google the 1996 political campaign and look at how Janet Reno decided not to appoint a special counsel related to illegal donations from people connected to pro-China politics and policies for Clinton's 1996 reelection campaign. That's how far back it goes. That's how in deep it goes. China was the epicenter of the 1918 flu pandemic, according to multiple historians, as reported in history. The bird flu, to give you an idea of how much China was on notice of the risk of this, bird flu, if or when planning for the next pandemic. When was this article written in the in the various medical journals? You could find it at the NIH, the National Institutes for Health, as part of the medical publications there, peer-reviewed, approved, and published. 2007. All the way back to 2007, they knew the next pandemic was going to come from China unless China changed its policies. China didn't, and what did we do? We were complicit in permitting them to have more economic power, more cultural power, more political power, because they were buying off our academic institutions, buying off our Hollywood enterprises, buying off our politicians en masse. They infected them with their own Chinese communist propaganda and virus that now has led to a real virus being on our shores, and a virus that's against the Constitution and economic liberty, infecting our politicians across the country from mayors to governors. Here's just one article from an Irish economics publication about how China became the world's biggest manufacturer, even though it barely held that title or could get anywhere near it just 15 years before. Wake up call, another headline article. Chinese control of U.S. pharmaceutical supplies. That's right. Our pharmaceutical supplies, key, critical, essential, fundamental for our physical, mental health. China controls it. China monopolizes it. China can shut it down. China can clog it up anytime it wants. The wake-up call, Chinese control of U.S. pharmaceutical supplies, sparks growing concerns as the article goes into detail about the degree and the scale and the scope to which China has ended up monopolizing essential products for our national security and our public health. China silenced doctor who first raised alarm about coronavirus, as the New York Times and even the Daily Beast had to admit and confess. The role in which China suppressed independent information about this pandemic by doing what they've been doing now for decades. And as in the Daily Mail, our Secretary of State is now demanding the truth. So when you come back on the bottom half of the hour, we'll be taking your calls. You can call in at 877-789-2539. And we encourage all of you to go to our sponsor, willing to sponsor this independent content because it's not bought and paid for by China. That's InfoWarsStore.com, where you can buy storable food now, today, before they prohibit you from even going to your grocery store next week. Welcome back to American Countdown. We'll be taking your calls this bottom half of the hour. I'll probably get to one or two calls, so call in, have your question ready. You can call in at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. Internationally at your country code, 512-646-1776. That's 512-646-1776. And we'll take your calls as part of the jury and try to answer those as best we can from the conversation tonight about China's culpability and complicity in the spread of this pandemic and the policy consequences that flow therefrom. In that context, Peter Navarro, a key trade advisor to the president, who warned about the potential policy consequences of this pandemic fallout and its economic implications, and has been warning about China for the better part of a decade, said China used the World Health Organization to hide the virus from the world with the consequences flowing therefrom. Now, if we look, if we went to the fact book, the Facebook fact checkers, they would tell us a completely different story about how China's not really on the hook at all, telling us about why vaccines are wonderful and beneficial, why nobody should be questioning the Chinese labs at organizations like Health Feedback or Science Feedback. Just go in and look at who the donors are to them. Look at their associations with pro-vaccine groups. Look at their associations with climate change groups. They have a political agenda. Look at their affiliations and associations through Duke University with the Chinese government, and you'll begin to understand the degree to which there's a certain shared agenda by some of these institutions that are not in the country's best interest, and that they themselves need to be fact-checked before they're further propagated. But that raises a question in that context. Today, Oliver Darcy reported that, in fact, Facebook was going to begin to act as an agent of the state in concert with the state, in cooperation and coordination and sometimes what they would call conspiracy with the state to suppress people's civil liberties and civil rights and to try to prevent them from organizing. What he put out on Twitter today was it said that anti-quarantine protests being organized through Facebook in California, in Nebraska, in New Jersey, were going to be suppressed or their pages removed. In fact, they were talking about, quote, removing any and all mention of the person's name and anybody else involved in the process. They were going to do so on the behest of various governments across the country. Well, the civil rights laws were deliberately designed to preclude and prevent that. While the state politicians later denied that they were the ones responsible for it, Facebook admitted it and confessed it to Oliver Darcy. And presuming that Oliver Darcy was not being inaccurate in reporting what he said, that would mean that, in fact, Facebook was acting in concert, legally and factually, with the various state government agencies in order to suppress, censor, and prevent protest and public speech in contravention of the First Amendment. And so what that means is under the civil rights laws, they provide that if you're a private participant in the suppression of civil liberties, either in concert with, at the behest of, or on the behest of a state actor of any kind, then you can be sued as a private entity under the civil rights laws. They did this because they feared in the 1870s that organizations like the Ku Klux Klan would organize with the local sheriffs, with the local judges, with the local political officials, and they would be the enforcement arm of the suppression of civil rights and civil liberties at the behest of and on behalf of and in concert with and in coordination with state officials, but that those, that then the Klan could be immune from suit and the state officials could be immune from suit because the hand of the operation, the hand of the body of the criminality and illicit conduct and violation of civil rights was private. And so Congress passed civil rights laws that prohibited private citizens from doing that and would hold private citizens, including companies, responsible and legally liable when they suppress or censor civil rights on behalf of governments. And that is what Facebook admitted today to Oliver Darcy at CNN. And that opens the door to civil litigation, to civil rights litigation against Facebook for removing anyone's protest page. So there's a range of groups, including groups from across the country, from Tennessee to Texas and Nebraska to New Jersey, who want to see their rights protected and remedies taken if Facebook acts in conformity with these state government requests. And if they do, I can guarantee you that such suits are and will be coming. Indeed, the civil rights issues that went to the core of these questions and these controversies were part of protests across the country this past weekend and are anticipated for more protests this weekend. Let's look at the video clip number one, and it's sort of in memory of this sign, which was at the protest, which simply said to choose freedom, not the Chinese flag, not the Chinese system, not the Chinese model, but choose the old values of the Texas Republic and the United States of America. So let's take a look at that video, a video clip from the protest. If we look at clip number one, for Texans standing up for not only the true values of Texas, but the true values of Americans from the time of our founding.
Texas! 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 Texas is awake! Texas knows the truth! Texas knows this is a Chi-Com globalist bioweapon meant to shut down our economy. America will reopen. Texas is leading the way. America knows it was a Chinese communist bioweapon. Everyone knows it's a globalist.
To protest to stop martial law so we can go outside when a Chinese communist launched an attack. And it turns out the woman that works for Bill Gates, who created the test, runs the lab and owns the test and does the fact checking for Facebook. Very small group of criminals, man. Very easy to beat them. Well, we got to admit we're being attacked by criminals to beat them. You got to admit they're criminals. You got to admit they're pulling this stuff to beat them.
And they've got their operatives out here now pissing, you know, the truth. But America knows this was the attempt to shut us down and shut down our free assembly and shut down our First Amendment. But Texas, I salute you all. Texas is leading the way against this journey. This freedom of speech, all Americans and all American businesses are essential. Don't let them tell you like the Nazis did that you are not essential. Whether you are old, whether you are young, whether you are black, whether you are white, you are essential. America is essential. And this is 21st century war attempting to shut us down. And Texas is leading the way against these tyrants. And I am honored to be with you. This sign says it all. Choose freedom. And we are leading the way out of this fraud. God bless you, and God bless Texas. Choose freedom. Choose America. Not fear, not propaganda. And the whole lie is falling in. It's all a psyop. God bless you. Other singers, get up here. We don't live in fear of some made-up virus. We know the globalists and the media are the enemy, and America is the worst. I salute you all. 1776 worldwide, Texas worldwide, USA, USA, USA. America is rising. Is the Chi-Com globalist bioweapon attack? Is the Chi-Com globalist bioweapon attack? And you have stood up against the enemy.
Now, that protest led to coverage around the world, but it was not the only protest. There were protests, in fact, all across the nation, from New Jersey to Maryland, from Maryland to Michigan, from Michigan to Minnesota, from Minnesota to across the nation, from to places like Indiana, places in Tennessee, places in Montana, places in California, any place and every place that could form a protest did, and did everything they could to organize, did everything they could to get active, did everything they could to make their voices heard across the nation as was needed and necessary to make sure there would be meaningful remedy during this time period of extraordinary suppression of civil rights and civil liberties that are unprecedented and unparalleled in our country's history. And it is in a context, by the way, the policy predicate and premise for this, aside from the fact that it simply cannot meet a narrowly tailored remedy to a compelling public interest as the strict scrutiny of constitutional core right deprivation compels under our U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence dating back to Korematsu versus the United States. The basis of all of this is various models and estimates and public health officials stating that unless these extreme actions were taken, that the remedy would end up being necessary because otherwise the disease would spread to plague-like levels, to millions dead within months. Well, those models, of course, proved completely in error. But this goes back to another correlated problem. In the same way that there's a question about whether the Chinese labs were responsible for the spread of this virus in some manner, either in helping to create it and helping to spread it, or in covering up some complicity it might have, or being complicit in the cover-up, maybe for its own independent reasons of fear of exposure or something that they may have done improperly, either in safety or security of handling viruses in general. But you have, this goes back. For example, consider this headline about what happened with the foot and mouth outbreak that concerned cattle in the United Kingdom towards the end of the last century. And the article that came out years later said UK labs suspected as the source of foot and mouth outbreak. Well, what else turned out to be relevant is that the same Imperial College and many of the same public health officials of the same type and kind who demanded all this sort of mass death of cattle, mass killing of cattle to a great economic risk to various farmers and others within the agricultural industry in the United Kingdom. It turned out they may have been completely wrong, as surveys and studies later showed that the models got the data wrong. The data they put in was wrong. So the policy outcomes they recommended that came with that were the output of that data were equally and co-equally wrong. This article describes it, mass culling for food and mouth disease may actually turned out unnecessary. In fact, this goes to the controversy involving one of the central figures at the Imperial College. And aside from the political controversy of funding from people like the Gates Foundation and others that some of these modelers are connected to, the controversy, as reported in the United Kingdom, is Neil Ferguson, the scientist who convinced Boris Johnson of the UK coronavirus lockdown as a public policy necessity, has been criticized for flawed research in the past, including past pandemics that he got wrong. This goes back to the United States and the last sort of flu outbreak fiasco we had, the last pandemic panic that we had in the United States, which was President Ford in 1976. As the article states, the long shadow of the 1976 swine flu vaccine fiasco. And they talk about how, in fact, that effort to do vaccines, what happened is they said that there was going to be this massive outbreak of a virus, a flu-like virus. It turned out they were wrong in the data they did. But they said the only solution, the only possible solution could be a rushed vaccine. And the vaccine ended up killing and harming far more people than the virus ever did. So when you hear people say that you can't second guess a vaccine, you can't question the vaccine political establishment, there is a notorious history of vaccines having this effect, particularly in this political context, particularly in this kind of circumstance where they're rushed to market. They're rushed under the pretext of solving the problem of a pandemic. They don't have a history of being very successful at defeating these kind of pandemics. Particularly flu-like pandemics and coronavirus-based pandemics, they all show a consistent history of not necessarily being the first and only solution to the problems of pandemics, particularly when they're flu-like and coronavirus in orientation and in identity. So that is why we should always be vigilant in second-guessing the billionaires obsessed with overpopulation who want to force-feed their agenda that is being enhanced by, for its own particular political reasons, with its affiliations and associations with China, Chinese associations, Chinese universities, Chinese academia, Chinese influence in the media industry, a Chinese government that has already posed such substantial and serious and significant risk in our economy, causing us massive loss of jobs and the spread of opioids and the spread of fentanyl in the United States to the same communities they decimated and destroyed with their job tactics and currency manipulation. We should be continuously and consistently vigilant with a Chinese society and culture that favors collectivism and cover up over full disclosure, transparency, and human rights, that whose own policies led to the deaths of millions and millions of its own people, who is discriminating against its own population to this very day for on religious basis, on basis of political expression, on the basis of simply wanting to have their own family. We should not be infected with the disease of the Chinese communist model of surveillance, this Chinese model that is using TikTok and Zoom and other means of and drones in our cities and counties and states to monitor and surveil our activities, often against our will and without our consent, and often without even our full knowledge or awareness. The Chinese model presents an ongoing risk not only to our public economy, not only to our supply chains, not only to our national security, not only to our information technology, not only to our intellectual property, not only to our actual physical security and public health, but presents the ultimate lethality and mortality risk of the Chinese model is to the American constitutional experiment itself in civil liberties and human rights. That is why we must continue to resist, continue to protest, just as people did in Austin, Texas last weekend, just as they're planning to do again this weekend in Austin, Texas, just as they're planning to do all across America, as is their right, as is their entitlement. And if Facebook makes the mistake and error of acting as the agent of state governments, you can go to places like can'tcloseamerica.com. Can'tcloseamerica.com, because that is a site where people are helping to organize, as Facebook and other organizations are trying to suppress your ability to organize, suppress your ability to speak out, suppress your ability of free speech and free press. Go to can'tcloseamerica.com where you can get the support. And in that same vein, I encourage you to support our sponsor. I purchase products from them all the time because they're products that I like, products that I enjoy. Those products range from coffee to supplements. Go to InfoWarsStore.com because it is one of the key places supporting your freedom and your liberty and your independence at this critical time in America. At InfoWarsStore.com, you can buy storable food in any degree of length of supply you want. It's wise to do so while there's even talk of shutting down grocery stores or limiting or rationing the kind of food access you can have. While the economic response and the political response to this pandemic put at risk, as you can see today, when oil prices actually went negative in the United States, you recognize the degree to which there can be exposure economically to you personally. So get that food and get your necessary supplies while you can, while they're affordable, while they're available to you, to be able to support you and your family so that you can be independent of any sort of political or economic response that may be forthcoming. So let's go and take some of your calls and see what you have to say. And let's go to Adam in Georgia.
Hey, Robert Barnes. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Thank you, sir.
Hey, I was a big fan of you before the show, and I cannot express how awesome your show is. I feel like, you know, we've got David Knight that starts our day off with a lot of common sense and groundedness, and we got Alex Jones that's, you know, fire and brimstone at this point in time. You're kind of the intellect that lays out just nonstop facts, but I wanted to maybe throw out a suggestion. You know, we've got all these protests that are really starting to fire up, opening up the country again. Thankfully, Governor Kemp of Georgia has gave a great speech today that he's going to be opening up things starting this Friday. Fantastic declaration that he's throwing out there. But I'm also a teacher, and so I'm teaching online right now. I've had to transition. I'm a fifth grade teacher, and I'm transitioning to online teaching, and I'm uploading videos and assignments. And so we were almost done with our social studies work for the year, and I'm at an independent school. And I felt like during this time we need to go back, look at the big things, the Magna Carta, going back to our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, And one of my favorite speeches of all time is Patrick Henry's call to arms in 1775. And so I had my kids go back, and they're doing an assignment this week on that speech. And I just think that it just struck me, you know, Alex was just at the Capitol with the bullhorn, USA, USA, USA. And that's fantastic. But why not create a speech? You know, all of you that are going to these events, create a speech. Go back and read Patrick Henry's speech and the fire and brimstone behind it, and create a speech that would ring true to our time right now that we're going through of taking back just the First Amendment. The very First Amendment has been taken from us. Why not? If you're going to go out with a bullhorn, don't go out and just spout off things that are going wrong. Create a speech. Think about what you're doing before you go out there. And I just think it might have a bigger impact than just, you know, random protests just shouting USA, 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 which gives me chills. But still, I think it could be even more powerful. And then I think that's all I have to say. And I appreciate what you do, Robert Barnes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. There's no question the power of rhetoric is often underestimated in our American Republic, particularly in the modern and contemporary age. And there's few better speeches than Patrick Henry's 1775 speech, Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, which in part originated in a defense to a criminal tax trial. When I was involved in the Wesley Snipes case, where I ended up using as one of my key reference points Patrick Henry's defense, because his original Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech was predicated and prefaced and previewed in a speech he gave in a criminal tax case in which his appeal to the jury was on sentencing grounds to give as low as possible a verdict to send a message to the world about the necessity and requirement of freedom from the form of colonial oppression the British Empire was imposing on Americans. And I ended up borrowing from that speech and arguing that just because the Liberty Bell was cracked in Philadelphia, it could still be heard in Ocala, Florida. And it was that day as West was acquitted of all the felony and fraud charges and even a majority of the misdemeanor charges against him under the circumstances, which shocked the world and pushed back the ability of the government to target people for political purposes. In that same vein, we should go back to those purposes of rhetoric. People like Frederick Douglass learned from Cicero's on rhetoric in order to teach himself. He made himself literate. He self-taught himself how to write. That is the old core principles of freedom and liberty we must celebrate again. And the best way to celebrate is, as our caller notes, not just to participate in political protests, not just to participate in public action, not just to participate in our public economy, but to go back and to appeal to our ancient liberties and ancient rights using the forms of contemporary and old rhetoric to remind people that in America, America is still America.